Welcome to Connectify Conversations. My name is Shannon Adair, and I'm the Director of Client Success at Connectify. Our mission is to share the experience, expertise, and insights from gaming industry leaders that comes from years of navigating the complexities and impact of compliance. On this episode, we have special guest.
My name is Paul Camacho, and I'm the VP of Compliance for Yamaba Casino.
Also with us today,
my name is Sean Topchi, and I'm the Director of Business Development at Connectify.
Thanks for joining us today, and remember to like and subscribe to the podcast. You can also learn more anytime at connectify.com. That's KINECTIFY.com.
Paul, thank you so much for joining us. It's a real pleasure to have you.
I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, we're really excited to have you here. Can you get us kicked off by giving us a little bit of your background?
Sure. So I'm currently the Vice President of Casino Compliance for Yamaba Casino. I am formerly the Special Agent in charge of the Las Vegas Field Office for IRS Criminal Investigation, where I spent 5 years there running financial crime investigation, money laundering investigations for all of Nevada and all of Utah.
It's a fascinating switch from that over to the casino side. But before we jump into that, though, really would like to know if there's any cases of particular interest that you worked in those days, obviously involving casinos. Don't want you to reveal anything that's confidential, but I'm sure there's some interesting stories there where casinos were intertwined.
Yeah. So when I ran the office in Vegas, it was the first exposure I really had to casinos. And one of the things I noted was that law enforcement in general throughout the country seemed to harbor a lot of stereotypes about what goes on in casinos. And they watched, people watch movies, they get an impression of what casinos are like. And I really wanted to make a concerted effort to really understand the industry. So during that time in my tenure as a special agent in charge, I instituted a liaison program to where I had every one of my agents assigned to certain casinos, and they acted as liaison, and we would interact with the casinos. We would try to understand their operations, and then we would in turn answer any questions or help them with compliance. And that really opened my eyes to understanding that people harbor a lot of stereotypes of what a casino is about and how you can launder money in a casino. And so that was a really fruitful endeavor. It led to helping law enforcement really understand what you can and can't do in a casino. It helped them understand that casinos are trying their best to be in compliance, and really they need as much guidance as possible to do that. And it also led to the beginnings of some really good public-private partnerships, which is now the expectation of FinCEN and law enforcement. I think that my theory of an AML program should be very patron focused, you know, so it's very due diligence patron focused. And look, the vast majority of people who gamble, they have a legitimate income. They're just there having fun. It's not like we're a haven for money launderers. But you can't have it be a check the box. I did this, I saved the searches, boom, I'm done. And you have to understand from the risk perspective what that means and what you need to do to mitigate that risk. What law enforcement has told us, particularly in Southern California, the head of office for IRS Criminal Investigation spoke to a group of us at a working group meeting and talked about the type of SARs casinos file and said, hey, you guys do a great job filing chip walk SARs, minimum play. We appreciate that. But there were a couple SARs that he felt, topologies that he really wanted, he felt that would be helpful. And one of them was what we call a spike in play. So there's a typology unusual for the customer or customers. And what they articulated to us was that these SARs and spike in play, they see a strong correlation. When I say spike in play, let's talk about that. When you're looking at patrons for due diligence, you shouldn't just be looking at a small window. If you have a history with them, you should be looking at that history. So if they gambled 5 years, you should know what they've lost every year when you're looking at them, especially when they hit your radars for enhanced due diligence. So if you see a pattern where they've lost, they're just using $20,000, $30,000 a year, and boom, they're $250,000, That's a pattern. That's an unusual pattern. How do you explain that? Now, there may be legitimate reasons. There are times when people inherit money. I've seen this. They could have won big. There are people who win at casinos. But according to what law enforcement was saying, they're saying that when they get an SARL, when they see that at a casino, there's a strong correlation. Let me step back. When they look at their fraud cases and they're involved in and they see a casino activity, there's usually a correlation where there was a spike in play. Now, that I don't care if that's not written in FinCEN guidelines. When the head of office for Irish Criminal, the largest user of SARs, tells you that, you're on notice that if you want to meet law enforcement expectation and quality, you need to do that. So that's, and I think that particular SAR topology is not common in the industry, but we're seeing, I think all of my counterparts are realizing that is something that you have to take under consideration. And especially when you take into consideration the risks of gambling addiction.
I love that you said that, because I think when you do those investigations for those spike in play, if you can explain it away, great. If they hit the wheel of fortune, hit $250,000, and then they gave it all back to the casino, obviously right. That's one thing. Or if they received an inheritance, I've had that where I investigated someone, turns out their mother died, they got a house, they got an inheritance to go along with it, it's fine. But when there are those cases, when it's unexplained, that is a particularly suspicious SAR that goes way beyond any structuring or any minimal gaming or any other SAR, most types of SARs that you're going to file. I'm glad you drew that point out. I want to cut and take that out and make sure we get that into some kind of quote afterwards, because I think that's a great point to get across for this.
I want to switch gears a little if we can. One of the things you've brought up a couple of times as you were talking about that is the importance of understanding the patrons who are coming in and what they're doing. I think that ties pretty nicely into your money laundering goal methodology, which is one of the things that we had hoped to talk to you about today. Can you give us a little more information on how you came up with that methodology and some other information about it?
As I go on, as I continue in this field, I realize that there's so much more I have to learn. I'm not an expert, but I do think that I like breaking down things into simple terms. I think I have a simpleton mind and a caveman mind where I just need things explained to me in a simple fashion for me to understand it. And if I expect that, it's not hypocritical if I try to explain something and try to talk above people's heads. And one of the things, so here's some observations. I started as a special agent in Irish Criminal Investigation, which is the premier financial investigation agency in the world. And I had the honor and pleasure to work with and supervise some really incredible men and women who were just monsters in money laundering investigations. They just built these huge money laundering cases and was able to bring down just really heinous criminals. And none of them to a T would ever go before a jury and explain money laundering by placement layering integration. In fact, if you talk to them, that whole model is not in their vocabulary. It's not part of the vernacular. They don't use it. And sometimes they find it comical when somebody outside county firm gives this poll report on money laundering and they're using all these terms and they're like, they find it comical, because here's some things. Like I said, number one, they don't use it, because the reason why they don't use it, number one, it's not in the criminal statute. When they define the criminal statute of money laundering, does not include any of those terms. Number two is it doesn't work all the time. You can't, if somebody defrauded somebody for $2 million, and then they go spend it at a casino, that's the crime of money laundering. It's over $10,000. It's the crime of money laundering. Tell me how that applies, that placement, layering, and integration. Now, another thing is that the Breaking Bad, I'm a huge fan of the series Breaking Bad. It's just classic. And there's so many classic scenes. But one of the classic scenes I just found so humorous was when Saul Goodman was telling Jesse he needs to buy a nail salon to launder his money. And the way he did it was he went into this whole diatribe about placement layering integration. There's this whole sermon on placement layering integration. So first you do this, and that's called placement. When you do, and he's going through that, and the camera, and then the camera's just focused on Saul Goodman. He was just passionately explaining these three turns and visually using his hand gestures. And at the end, the camera pans to Jesse, and he's just deadpan, like, you want me to buy a nail salon? It was so funny in my world, because that whole placement layering just went way over his head. Not only did it go way over his head, it was just annoying him. It was just, it served no purpose other than it was great dialogue. And it was funny. But when I first started a liaison with law enforcement, when I started at my previous employer and still had a lot of I have a lot of contacts with law enforcement. They were asking me to give training to criminal investigators on the state and local level, help them with training on teaching them casino money laundering. Now, mind you, these are people who aren't IRS special agents. They didn't work money laundering cases. And then they were going to look at SAR, BSA information to try to develop cases and understand how a casino could be used for money laundering. The last thing I was going to do was say, let's talk about placement layering integration, because it served no purpose. So what I realized in my efforts to explain, teach money laundering to people who didn't grow up in the AML world was money laundering is really simple when you think about it. When you look at money laundering, what's their ultimate goal? Their ultimate goal in money laundering is they don't want their money trails to put them in jail or get their assets seized, right? That's the ultimate goal. But in order to accomplish that goal, they'll do certain transactions that will go to that goal. Now, placement layering integration is a great model to explain how they achieve that goal through three different, like this money laundering cycle. And if I'm a transnational organized crime and I'm dealing with a lot of cash and I want to put money in the bank and then move money around in layers and eventually get it over, okay, knock yourself out, placement layer integration. But most crime in this country is not, when you look at this, let's look at street level crimes and versus transnational drug trade organizations. Only 14% of the profit through the whole drug trade goes to these large organizations. Most of it, that money is swirled around in street criminals and mid-level criminals who do not need to go through this whole placement layer integration. Their money laundering could just be one transaction. So when I looked at trying to teach money laundering to law enforcement and teach money laundering to people who just never had a background, I was like, why can't I just break it down to what are they really trying to do? And I came to this conclusion that there are six things that you can accomplish in a casino, or actually in any type of money laundering. Your transactional goal. What are you trying to do? One is you're trying to conceal that transaction. You're trying to hide who the beneficial owner is. And it could, your money laundering for a street level criminal can be as simply as a false ID. Like a street criminal who doesn't have, they're not in real estate, they're not in cars. All they need to do is just everything in cash and make sure nothing's in their name. Use a false ID. That's the extent of their money laundering. They're just concealing. Now, there are other, you know, another goal of money laundering is you may want to convert your money to another form. So you might be a street criminal, you have all these small bills, and you're not going to go around spending all these small bills. You want $100 bills, because if you were to go buy drugs from the upper levels, they may only want $100 bills, or, you know, $100 bills are easy to carry around. So all you need in your money laundering is just to convert these bills. And then that's all you need. And so your only goal you want is just converting. Then you might have just the goal of just transferring money to another person, another confederate in your scheme. And that's it. You commit a crime and you just want to transfer in a way that nobody knows about it. So there's transferring. And then some might have a goal of just trying to clean the money. All that is trying to attach an alibi. Just attach an alibi. A W-2G, the government gives you this, it's legal. They give you this legal way to launder money. Because they create this form called the W-2G, and right on the W-2G, it says you're a winner. here's your winnings. And maybe their goal is just to play, just get a generate a W-2G and cop pulls them over and they have that W-2G. They just show it to them. And it's very successful because there's a big FBI case where the person got acquitted using the scheme. So it's a great, but so it's just cleaning. And then you can just have a goal. I get all this money and I'm just going to spend it. I don't really, and this happens a lot with people who are fraudsters, especially people who may be fueled by gaming addiction. And they're just, they got a bunch of money and then they're just going to spend it. So you're thinking, that's not money laundering. Yeah, it is. It's in the statute. And you can't bifurcate the theory of money laundering with the actual crime of money laundering. You have to, and so it's just spending. And then the last one is storing. So maybe your goal is you commit all this crime and you just want to store it someplace that people can't, they can't find it. And that's it. You're just going to draw a little. You don't need a placement, Larry. You can store it in casino chips. You can store it in Bitcoin. So conceal, convert, transfer, clean, spend, and store are the goals, the essential backbone goals of what you're trying to do in money laundering. So this is the, why are they conducting this transaction? Why? Because either I'm trying to conceal it, I'm trying to convert it, I'm trying to transfer it, clean it, spend it, or store it. And when you understand the why and you teach, instead of saying people will, you got to look for people who are structuring. Look for people structuring. And you just tell that to law enforcement or people in a casino. There's a casino, they're like, oh, structuring is a crime. It's money. I'm like, no, it's not. Excuse me. Structuring could be a crime if there's illegal proceeds attached to it. But what are they really trying to do? They're really trying to hide that transaction. They don't want their name. That's really what they're trying to do. Now, grandma, who has a legal source funds, and she may only gamble, she puts in the slot machines every day, 8,000, 9,000, 7,000. But it looks like she's trying to avoid a CTR, but grandma doesn't have a, try to explain to me what her goal, what's her goal? Grandma has legitimate money and that's how she gambles. And there, so it's the why that makes, because often what happens when I came up with this and I first started teaching it to law enforcement, and the California Bureau of Gaming, they were training people using my methodology. And it really empowered them to understand. So if I teach you the why, then you can come up with other ways that I might even not know of. Well, Paul, there's another way you can hide, or there's another way you can clean. Because I taught them the why. I'm teaching you how to fish, as opposed to, Paul, I found another way that they can minimally play. Yeah, but a lot of minimal play, a lot of times is not money laundering because it's just that it's just how people gamble. Grandma could be feeding one machine to get the tickets. And then she pulls that ticket out and he sticks in another one. She gambles. I'll take grandma's money all day because she's legitimate. She's having a great old time. Best of both worlds. Everybody benefits, but grandma's not money laundering. But the transaction wise, oh, she's minimal playing on this one machine. So, no, let's go back to the goals of money line. What conceivably could grandma trying to be accomplished when you know about grandma? Now, the key thing with these goals, so you understand there's six ways that you can launder money. The key thing is predicated on understanding the patron. So you can't disassociate the transaction from the patron. And that's a key thing in my methodology is, okay, before you start trying to figure out the goal, who is the person conducting the transaction? Usually the way they teach money laundering in casinos is that you just look for the typology and then you say that's money laundering, possible money laundering. No. Let's step back. Let's first who, and then why would they do it? And it's interesting. Oh, I developed this, I think about 3 years ago, and how useful this has been to me and others. When somebody from operations or somebody calls me and says, hey, they start going over some transaction. And when you sit there, okay, stop. Okay, let's talk about the money laundering goals. Could they try to conceal it, convert it, transfer, clean, spend, store, and luff? And it's no, they can't accomplish anything. So you have your answer.
There's a few different reasons I really like the idea of this. One that you talked about was really tying it back to the statute, right? Is what constitutes money laundering crime based on our statutes. And so much of the layering, integration, placement, and all that doesn't really get to it. Two, so many of those phases of layering, placement, integration, all the things that would have to take place for that it just doesn't happen in a lot of cases, unless you are that big organization that you're talking about. It's so much more simplified than that. It is just a fraudster who goes straight to spending it, unfortunately, maybe because they do have something like an addiction. So this simplification, I think, brings the level of understanding. And I can imagine this has been incredible for training, and want to get more thoughts from you on training with your properties, what you've seen and the success you've had with it. Another, I like this, and I think I've started to see this, seen a few more articles and studies on this with human trafficking investigations and developing red flags as well, is stopping some of this traditional methods we have, maybe not stopping, but maybe not relying on these traditional methods, and relying more on developing personas. Who are the types of people? What are these people trying to accomplish? So what is this individual up to, rather than what are these transactions telling us? And I think that persona-based approach can be great and ties into what you're talking about here, the who that goes along with the why. And I think for human trafficking as well, is this person a victim? Is this person a facilitator? Is this person a handler? Is this person the purchaser, so to speak? That drives a lot of the why behind the transactions you're seeing and the activities you're seeing them conduct. And if you don't understand those personas, like grandma, for example, something could look suspicious when in reality, her favorite slot machine was taken up. So she was just aggregating her cash for one big ticket for the second that opened up so she could go play on it. And that's
exactly,
it's such an important factor that gets missed out on so much of the time.
You take your human trafficking. So let's look at the money line goals. You see somebody who might be a victim of human trafficking, a sex worker, and you see them trying to convert cash into a Tito ticket. And you're like, why? The why is it's easier and less suspicious to transfer that to the pimp. The pimp may say, just give me Tito tickets. Because then if somebody asks me, I have this Tito ticket. Or you're converting to a lot of small bills, or she might stuff a machine and then get a Tito. So you're taking all these small bills and it's just one piece of paper. And another why when it comes to human trafficking, why is that person always, why are they playing slot machines, but they're not getting any rated play? They don't use their card. It doesn't make any, they're missing out on this free play. They're acquiring W-2G. So pimp goes to the airport and customs says, where'd you get this $30,000? Here's my W-2G. I got $30,000 from ABC Casino. Call them up. And if you call ABC Casino, they're going to go, yeah, we issued that guy a W-2G, but he doesn't have any rated play. He's playing a card. I don't know if he's a winner. And then they have to let the money go. So why is that person not, why are they not getting rated play? And then when you look at who, it's like, yeah, he's trying to create this alibi, trying to clean or convert or transfer. And then the other thing too, is when you are teaching people who are the front line, you're not training them to be, oh, you have to be this money laundering expert and understand the whole cycle of money laundering. It's no, I just want you to analyze transactions, individual transactions. And I want to develop your spider sense to understand the why. When something seems unusual, a patron does something unusual, sit back and go, why? And then you look at, I have a cheat sheet, look at these six things, like, could they be trying to hide? And often it gives you some comfort. No, I don't see how they can accomplish any of those goals.
Yeah, it's, I like how you said, developing that spider sense. And I think for those frontline workers, having this simplification, and I don't want to call it simplification because I think it's a well thought out methodology, but having it broken down in a way that you can communicate it more simply allows people to start asking questions, especially if they start to look at the who. This guy comes to the cage, doesn't have a rewards card, or is getting a rewards card for the first time because in order to be able to conduct a credit card advance, he has to have a rewards, and he's taking out $5,000 or $7,000 or $8,000 or $9,000. Right. This isn't a regular player. Why would someone be doing that? And that spider sense of starting to ask yourselves those questions, and it could be nothing, but for the frontline person, that's something that's at least worth reporting of, hey, we've got someone that's not a known customer, that doesn't play here, that didn't get a rewards card, that got a rewards card here for what appears to be just to be able to take out a large advance. And so when you're able to start looking at the who a little more, I think for that front line is so important to be able to start reporting those kinds of things, which traditionally haven't seen a lot of with frontline reporting. But I think for you with Yamavan, probably even the Palms now, there's a pretty robust reporting system at the front of house.
Yeah. And when you give that example of a large cash advance, you would, one of the things you would consider is like the why is, are they trying to convert non-currency to currency? And they have a lot of fraud schemes is where they would use a mule, unsuspecting mule, put money in an account. And let's look at their money laundering cycle. So in a lot of these things, their whole money laundering cycle is not trying to get money into the financial institution. It's already there. It's trying to get the money out of the financial institution. And it's just trying to convert it to a form that's easier and more that's anonymous.
Exactly. And I think there's two topics that I think we've lightly touched on and want to get a little deeper into them. One of them, and we've said it a couple of times, is people with addiction. And I know you've got some interesting thoughts on that intersection of what we call, I think, politically responsible gaming and AML.
So this is an interesting topic. I think there's three things that we just have to overlay when we're looking at it. And this is not me just saying this. I will tell you, amongst my counterparts that run AML programs and doing it for a while, a lot of the experts in casino money laundering, not only in the United States, but in other countries, there is an agreement that we feel, we know that one of the biggest risks that a casino face in terms of it is the risk of problem gamblers committing crimes to fund their gambling. And so you take that. So you have this risk. And this is, look, you can go to the webpage for California Council on Problem Gambling. And right on the webpage, they estimate the cost of gambling addiction related to from crime, incarcerations, bankruptcies at $7 billion. That's just California. Now you take that, and I could throw out other things where you go to the Mayo Clinic, you go right on the Mayo Clinic, and it says, if you have a problem with compulsive gambling, you may continue to chase your bets that lead to losses, use up savings and create debt. You may hide your behavior and even turn to theft or fraud to support your gaming addiction. And even the state of Nevada recognized the correlation between gaming addiction and crime. They've actually created a gambler's court. And what this gambler court realizes that if you don't get somebody with this problem, they don't get them counseling, when they get out of jail, they're just going to commit more crime. So you have that. So it's a known factor that, and let me just say before I go on, the vast majority of people who gamble at casinos, they gamble responsible. They have a great time. We're talking a very small percent of the over of the population that is affected by this. So vast majority of people walk through your door, they're having a good time, they do not have a problem. And the casinos provide a really a lot of value, entertainment value. So we're just talking a small percent of the casino population, but the small percent of the population, they can cause you a lot of problems if you don't understand this risk and don't calibrate your due diligence programs to identify it. Because if you don't take this risk under consideration, there's some ugly cases that come about. Let me just read you some headlines of just recent headlines. Cashier steals $13 million. Lawyers blame it on gambling addiction. Shelby County woman sentenced to federal prison for embezzling $1.4 million from HOAs to feed gambling addiction. Convicted travel agent blames gambling addiction for theft. Former Louisiana Senator, Democrat Party chair, is charged with wire fraud to fuel gambling habit. Casino catfish allegedly swindles $1.2 million to fund gambling habit. And this one even made world news. 80-year-old nuns gets year in prison for stealing $835,000 from schools to pay for gambling habit. And what does she say to the judge? I have sinned. These cases, they generate a lot of negative news. And especially when you're in tribal gaming, you're so focused on protecting the tribe's reputation. And the tribal gaming does not want to facilitate this. And you know these type of criminal activities. So you take that. So there is no question that there's a correlation. So you take that correlation, and then you overlay it with the expanded growth and opportunities to commit fraud. And you think about it, over the past 5 years, especially with COVID relief, all these subsidy programs, and what you can do on the internet. It is so much easier and more profitable to commit fraud than ever. We are living in a renaissance of fraud, and you're crazy to rob a bank now. You're crazy to commit violent crime to get money when you can just commit ID theft. And it goes on and on. So you have this situation where there's a risk of a patron class. You have now this expanded opportunity, COVID relief, just the P loans alone. And then the tax credits you can get by just having dummy companies. Then you take that, so those two factors, and you add another factor. And that factor is, during COVID, it really hampered law enforcement. You got about a two-year window where they were not functioning in all pistons. Courts were shut down. They couldn't go interview people. They couldn't travel. Grand juries were shut down. Staffing shortages. But when you got to think of crime, going after crime as an assembly line, right? And you got to keep on processing because there's more. And if there's a backup, a slowdown, that's a factor. So you overlay these three things. And from somebody who's running an AML program in a casino, you have to take that in consideration as a risk factor and calibrate that in the way that you conduct due diligence. Because let me put it to this way. There is no other financial institution where somebody will commit a crime to be your customer. Think about that. There is no other financial institution where somebody will commit a crime to be your customer. And I say that because there's a lot of big money laundering that you can't do in a casino.
Sure.
Because I think people have stereotypes about casinos and what you can do and money laundering havens, and Robert De Niro is a general manager and Joe Pesci runs the AML program. Just these awful stereotypes about casinos. And which I try to make sure people understand, that's not the way. People want to do the right thing, want to comply. But we do have this unique risk. Even though we can't set up corporations and move money all around the world, and we're a highly regulated industry, money launderers don't like to go to a highly regulated industry, we still have this unique risk. And if you look at the people that have broken bad, there are elements of this. And I think that there's best practice you can adopt to deal with this. And I wrote this article, Elvis and the Fraud Triangle in ACAMS, and I outline how your AML program can deal with it. And it gets back to just tried true, applying the fraud triangle and understanding that when you do due diligence on patrons now, you have to consider, you have to take into consideration that a risk of gaming addiction. When you look at that fraud triangle, it's pressure, rationalization, and opportunity, right? And every casino compliance department should have people trained on the fraud triangle and understanding how to look for fraud, because fraud is going to be your most likely illegal proceeds going to enter a casino. And they talk about pressure. Pressure is what motivates a person to commit fraud, financial hardships, maintaining lifestyles, and they talk about addictions. Now, according to the Ohio State Office of State Auditors, this is baked into auditors' procedures. One common pressure is a gambling problem. And then, you know, when it comes to rationalization is talking yourself into a crime. And a lot of times people who commit crime for fraud for the first time, they're first time offenders and they think they're honest people. But a compulsive gambler will rationalize that all they have to do is win big and all their problems go away because they'll be able to pay their victims. And so when you're doing due diligence as a casino, you have to you're not trying to diagnose and say that person's a problem gambler. That's not your job. Your job as an AML program is to understand risks, and you apply appropriate procedures based on risk. So it's right there in your face. So you those three things I talked about, you have a risk. You have a patron class that will do this. You will have a patron class that will commit a crime to be your customer. Now you take that into consideration. So when you apply the fraud triangle, opportunity may be there. Rationalization might be there. You're not saying they're a gambling addict. That's not what you're doing. Not diagnosed, but what you are going to do is you're going to look for opportunities. And you're going to understand when you do that due diligence that when you say, she's a bookkeeper in a small company, I found she has a source of funds, we're good. No, she's a bookkeeper at a small company and she's losing $500,000 a year or even $250,000 a year. Take into consideration the fraud triangle you have, and that may be, you need to go maybe talk to the patron, get more information. Maybe she did get an inheritance. And it may mean that you have to file an SAR, and it may mean that if they can't provide any more information, then you might have to ban them.
There's two pieces there that I really want to pull out. One, I think you hit the nail on the head when we're talking about the risks as an industry. We really are the only financial-like institution that people want to come to, that people like to come to, that they'll commit crimes to be able to come to enjoy it to the extent that you can. I think the other piece that I think you indirectly really said and are honing in on is when you're talking the fraud triangle, I think where maybe people aren't seeing the pressure point is the addiction itself. And so that's something where, you know, if we're trying to use the fraud triangle and we're trying to complete all the pieces of the puzzle, that's something that we need to realize, even though maybe they don't have some kind of other financial hardship where they lost their job or anything like this. The addiction itself is what's causing the financial hardship that's leading them to do this. So those are two fantastic points.
Yeah. And again, you're not, your job is not to diagnose. You can't say for sure they're a gambling addict, but in an AML program, I need to emphasize this. It's all risk-based. It's just like when people bring in cash, a large amount of cash, you cannot say that they're all drug dealers or human traffickers, but it's a risk. And that's what people have to understand. And look, again, the vast majority of people walk in, they gamble responsibly. So you can't go, that's why you can't go in and just say, oh, they're definitely, you can't do it. You're not a clinician. You're not qualified to do that. It really just means at the end of the day, and this is what sometimes might be challenging casinos, like you may have to ask that patron to provide documentation. You may have to dig deeper. And the other thing, there's a training component that you need to make sure that your casino does, is that when they get responsible gaming training, the compliance team needs to come in there and connect the dots and say, look, you got this training, but you do understand that they can commit crimes. They'll commit crimes and they may use this to gamble. And so you have to report to us when things don't smell right. We're not asking you to tell, you're not diagnosing, but when a patron comes in and you factor this risk and you've known them for years and they've always tried to, they're struggling with money. And then all of a sudden they come with all this wealth and they don't have the skill set to get, they're not, how did they get this $250,000, $500,000 out of the blue? And they're always at the casino still. They don't even have time to work. You can't just say, Fred got lucky. Fred finally found that career job. You can't do that. You have to communicate to compliance. And so they can do like a financial health check. They can, and maybe Fred did to get that inheritance, but it's way better considering this risk that we in the background can find it out. And because it may be like, Fred should not have this money. In fact, he has a string of charges recently, or there's some negative news report about Fred, those type of things. Or Fred's now associated with this charity. You have to take that into consideration. And I think it's important the industry comes up with best practices that are not onerous, that they're not intrusive on patrons, because if we do this, I think we're much better off, because in other countries, the rules on this are really draconian. If you look at other countries and how they require certain things, I think it's better that we set the framework. And again, most people are responsible gamblers. At a minimum, if your casino is concerned about reputational risks and law enforcement attention, factor this in. This is, I'm telling you, this is like my Martha Stewart tip, right? Mind your P's and Q's on this. Understand the risk. Build it in to your AML program, and it will bear fruits in maintaining that reputational risk.
Yeah, it's got to be a documented part of the risk assessment. It's got to be in there, I think.
Well, do you have any thoughts on how this plays out with interactive gaming, where these players that are willing to commit crimes to gamble now have 24/7 access to doing so?
So I'm not an expert in this, and Now just let's just draw back onto our basic understanding of this. A concern with any type of gaming that you're offering that's not going to be at the casino is that, number one, they're not doing it in front of you. They're not going to be in a situation where people look out for situations of problem gambling, is there to offer support. You just can't see it. And another concern is underage, people gambling that are underage, because there's some, from being told by people who are experts of this, is that younger age people, especially when it's in the confines of their home, can really get problem gambling, could be more, the risk of problem gambling could go up. You have these stories where kids have just got a hold of credit cards, parents' credit cards, and they go crazy on those just to feed that. And again, I'm not the expert on this. I just think that if you're providing sports wagering, mobile sports wagering, you need to have a robust AML program. and that AML program needs to consider this risk factor and understanding who that person is gambling. This is where on the analytics on any type of mobile wagering, internet wagering, is where the analytics really, man, they really are something you need to stress in terms of spikes and plays or just unusual patterns or anything that may indicate that you need to dive in and who is really gambling.
I completely agree with you there. I think it's harder for us. We were talking personas and knowing the person. It's so much harder, I think, in this interactive environment where we do have to rely on those analytics more. And I think there's got to be a little more pressure on ourselves as an industry to start figuring out what all those points are. Chasing losses, obviously, but what are, taking it back from like this like existential responsible gaming crisis, what are simple things that we can do? Like, how do we have better case management around identifying those people? What are some of those analytical points? Is it chasing losses? Is it how fast they burn through deposits? How fast they redeposit? Situations like that, where we start to break down these multiple data points so we can draw out which of these analytics are useful for us to be able to identify these problem gamblers early on. And so not to just have an effective AML program, but to have a robust, responsible gaming program where we can identify early on. Can we provide resources early on so that it doesn't get to the standpoint where they are committing fraud just to play, not in just our casino, to do mobile sports wagering, to do this mobile iGaming. So I think with interactive gaming, where the accessibility just goes through the roof, or the convenience, I guess, since casinos are 24/7, a lot of them, where the ease of access goes through the roof, I think the intersection between responsible gambling and AML is just getting so much closer, and they're bleeding together so much more.
Yeah, that is a consensus of my counterparts. And what's great about the environment now in casino AML is that so many of us amongst the casino industry chat a lot more formally in our working groups and informally just picking up the phone. We'll chat informally at least a couple times a month, but the consensus of all this, all the people that I know, is that this is a risk that we need to be more proactive in addressing, and in particular, making sure our operations understand this so they can be proactive and identify certain situations where we really just need to dive deep and understand where that money is coming from.
I think that's really a fantastic kind of closing point, Paul. I know we had a range of topics that we haven't gone to. I think we wanted to get deeper into human trafficking, elder financial exploitation, the tribes and how they view their reputation, how they view their investment into the community, even the importance of history of AML. I know you are with the Mob History Museum, you are the AML history buff. We could probably go on for three more hours, but maybe we stop here, and I'm going to put you on the spot here. And I would love to invite you back for a Connectify Conversations with Paul Camacho part two.
I rambled so much, you might have two parts or three parts, but I'd love to come back and talk about just the history. I think understanding the why of money laundering, you have to go back to understanding how we got here, because it really is a made for Netflix series story about how it originated, just going after mobsters, organized crime, and started in 1945 is when the banks were first required to report currency transactions. And just understanding the evolution and how pop culture how regulatory concern or the concerns on the Hill, the reading the tea leaves of the population, how all this comes together and has formed the AML regime. But getting back what I first started with on the FinCEN reports, it is pretty impressive that something started in 1945 and is still, it has become even more so an important tool to law enforcement, and how that thing that started, that it was called Form TCR1, how that started, how that influenced AML throughout the world, and how people mirrored the US AML regime. And today, back then, 1945, it was Irish criminal investigation that was using those. And today, Irish criminal investigation is still by far the biggest users of BSA information. So that ability to follow the money and honing in that ability to follow the money and how integral these BSA forms play is still even more present today than it was back then. And then there's just the whole history of Vegas, because we deal with this whole organized crime, and I don't want to discount that. There are some just great stories and how that developed into this highly regulated industry. But yeah, Vegas wouldn't have been Vegas if it wasn't for Meyer Lansky, Busby Siegel,
absolutely,
Mo Galitz, Benny Binion, all these people who were affiliates or kingpin gangsters. That's Vegas. That's how Vegas got its start. And so that's an interesting understanding, that you're always going to deal with stereotypes. You're always going to, in the industry, it's really hard to walk away when one of the most popular movies ever made was the movie Casino or The Godfather. When you have and then you have Ozark, which is ridiculous money laundering, but it was just a great series. I just love that series. But
it was hard to turn my AML brain off on that one when I saw the way they were describing certain parts of it, but wildly entertaining series.
Yeah, it's like you can't, it's so old school, ridiculous money laundering. But what do they use? They use a casino because it had so much sex appeal. There's all these stereotypes. That's why it created great theater. And why use a bank when you can have somebody walk through a casino? And
I think I speak for all of us when I say I'm looking forward to part 2 already.
That is a wrap for today. Paul, thank you so much. It's been a great conversation. I always love hearing from you.
Thanks again for joining us today on Connectify Conversations. You can support our show even more by leaving us a rating wherever you download your podcast and by sharing Connectify Conversations with gaming industry leaders like yourself. Visit connectify.com to learn more. That's KINECTIFY.com. Until our next conversation, always remember to minimize risk and maximize your efficiency.